Welcome to Farm Foundations, the podcast where we cultivate the roots of homesteading and sustainable living. I'm Tyler Lowry, and I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-host, Bo Prock.
Hey there, folks. Excited to be here and share our passions for all things homesteading.
And our resident expert and founder of Farm Foundations, Joe Grissom.
Pleasure to be here, everyone. I've spent a lifetime working, producing my own healthy food and living off the land. I can't wait to share what I've learned with all of you.
Whether you're a seasoned homesteader or you're just getting started on your journey to self-sufficiency, this podcast is your go-to resource for practical advice, inspiring stories, and expert insights.
That's right, Tyler. Each week, we'll be delving into topics like sustainable agriculture, backyard gardening, food preservation, and everything in between.
From planting your first seed to putting up reserves for the winter, we've got you covered. Together, we'll explore the joys of farm-to-table living and the timeless wisdom of living close to the land.
So grab your gardening gloves, dust off your canning jars, and join us as we sow the seeds of a more self-reliant and fulfilling life.
Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll take a deep dive into poultry infrastructure in the second installment of our poultry series.
All right, folks, we're glad to have you back. Just as a quick recap here. We are right in the middle of our poultry series where we've got three parts here. Last week we talked and we had our poultry primer. We had a high level overview of homestead poultry husbandry. And we had a guest with us last week. She's also here again with us this week, Jessie Robar. We're going to talk a little bit more today in part two of our series on poultry infrastructure. We're going to take a more in-depth look at necessary equipment and setup that you need for various types of poultry. And then next week, we're going to be back with bird care and management, and we're going to take an in-depth look at the care and management of various poultry species. So to get us kicked off here, we'll start with our weekend review. Jesse, we're excited to have you back. Do you want to kick us off and tell us a little bit about what you've had going on this week?
This week, a bunch of my raised beds came in, so I've been working on setting those up this week. I made 8 or 9 loaves of sourdough bread, and I have tilled the ground for my raspberry patch that I said I would never do again, but here we are.
What was your struggle with raspberries? Why did you curse those?
Just the rocks in Missouri.
Ah, well, yeah. We do know the Robar.
Missouri is awful.
The Robar quarry is in full production.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, you want to tell us a little bit about what you've had going on this week? I know we got in on that sourdough bread that Jesse baked and had some amazing steak sandwiches tonight. What else have you had going on here on the farm?
Well, this week we got an awful lot of rain, so we lost several days of outside work to the much-needed rain. We were glad to have it, but it required a lot of office work and time spent indoors. Worked in the abattoir, or what we like to call Opa's meat shop. We did some house cleaning and worked on some sausages. We fed the baby goats. We worked in the greenhouse. Everything is coming to fruition. Worked in the medical garden just a little bit. I guess that's pretty much it. Nothing really jumps out. Spent some time working in the flower beds.
I know you talked about working in the office a little bit. I know it's kind of an exciting time. We're working on getting some classes together for you guys as listeners, and we're making some real progress in that arena. Hopefully, we'll have some announcements here coming soon to that effect. But you definitely did get a lot of work done, especially with all the rain that we've had, and we're appreciative of that. Bo, what have you had going on your homestead this week?
So we planted some strawberries and some herbs in the gutter garden that we posted on Facebook a couple days ago. We built 2 more very large raised beds, and then I ordered 4 more that we got put together and getting ready to hopefully get all the rest of the plants in the ground. And then we moved our chickens from free range back into their chicken tractors because they found the garden and dug up a bunch of my seeds. And they also evidently got kind of broody, and I found 3 different nests on the property that were just full of eggs. So they all went back to the tractors for a little bit. We're just going to move them daily for a little while and make sure we get all of our eggs.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good segue into what we're going to talk about today. So as we move into our first segment here today, let's just get an understanding of poultry housing. So to kind of kick us off, let's just take a moment and discuss the importance of providing appropriate housing for poultry. So what are we looking for here? We're looking at things like protection from predators, protection from weather, and protection from disease. What are some things we need to understand about those first three challenges when it comes to housing poultry?
All three of those would be the reason that we originally went with the chicken tractors. We found these tractors 2 years ago, I guess, at a homestead convention type deal that me and Joe went to. They were extremely pricey. There are much cheaper options out there. But these are, I think they're 4x6 tractors. I bought two of them. They have a very nice rollout nest box that goes on the back of them, tarp covering. They're all made out of galvanized and aluminum. It's very, very well built. So, you know, I went that route, you know, to take care of the predators. You know, it's very predator safe. Moving them every day, you know, keeps the chances down of a predator, you know, digging under whenever it's constantly moved. They have, you know, plenty of shade for the heat. The sides roll up, so in the winter we can, you know, put them down to keep them warm, roll them up in the summer to keep them cool. And then moving them every day, you know, I think surely helps, you know, with the disease factor. You know, they stay clean-footed, moving to fresh grass every day, so.
I don't know to what degree you probably have a little bit of reduction in feed costs with rotating them every day. They have fresh forage, fresh grasses that they can pick on a little bit. Maybe some fresh bugs that they get a chance to eat.
Yeah, I'm going to say not near as much as free range. You know, I've put them back on the mix of layer pellets, crumble, and basically just a bird seed mix that I'm feeding them pretty heavy now. Because chickens really, I don't think people understand just how big of workhorses chickens are. So in that 4x6 or 6x8, I can't remember exactly what it is, they'll pretty well, you know, trample that grass down to nothing within a day. And I think I've got 7 birds per tractor. Yeah, you've got to keep them moving. We should probably actually move twice a day. We should probably move every morning and every evening.
I know they're pretty heavy, and I was reading a little bit before you guys got here today. I was reading a white paper. It says about 50% of the cost of poultry production is in feed. So they're pretty hungry animals when we think about it. I know Joe and Jesse, you guys have got more permanent setups as far as your poultry housing. What do you see as maybe difficulties or benefits with that permanent housing when it comes to predator protection, weather protection, and disease protection?
My chicken coop is probably 100 years old. It was, well, maybe not quite. It's getting close to 100 years old. It was built here on this farm probably in the 30s. It's two-sided. One side is larger than the other. There's a chicken coop and a brooder area. The chicken coop in and of itself has got a concrete floor. And it's made with solid walls all the way around, no windows, a man door, and a chicken door. So it's pretty self-explanatory. The birds are out or you know, in a chicken yard. Or I open the man door during the correct seasons. Like Bo said, you know, when my birds discover the garden, I put them up. And when I don't have a garden going, I let them out. My food costs just double. When I put the birds in the coop, It's just that. It doubles. You know, I go out and throw a little bit of feed. They're happy and they're productive when they're out. But when I close them up, their eggs will drop off until I double the feed. And then I get the production that I need, or get the production I think they're capable of. But I also feed them every bit of vegetable and kitchen waste that we have available. I think it's very important that you give those chickens a very variety. To Bo's point, they're workhorses. Anything that I can compost, I bring to the chickens first. If they don't use it, if they don't eat it, they poop on it, and then I remove that material and put it in part of my compost system. So hugely important, not only for the calories that we derive from them in either meat or egg production, but in the fertilizer that we get in our compost system.
Jesse, what are your thoughts? Do you have any challenges specific to having a more permanent poultry housing solution?
At our house, it's mostly mud. We're really struggling with keeping the mud down. We've just added like 8 inches of mulch to the turkey pens because the turkey pens just turn into an absolute muddy mess. But they do have a place to get out, like just a shed. And then it's got a human door and a chicken door. And then we've dealt some with critters, but most of the point at this point right now, it's mud. They just get too many diseases from that mud.
I want to talk a little bit more about the weather. I know, so at their root, chickens technically originated from Southeast Asia and the tropics. So when we get up into an area like us, we're definitely not a tropical climate. So how is weather affecting you guys, and how important is that of a consideration when we think about poultry housing?
I mean, again, the setup I have, my chickens have done well in the heat. The only place where I have lost birds is in the cold. And I think I mentioned that on one of our first podcasts that I've got to change a few things whenever winter time comes. And part of that might be more inside the tractor time, maybe add some straw and stuff to that and keeping them in that enclosed, because I didn't lose any birds in the tractors. Any bird that I lost was out of the tractor and didn't get out of the wind and the cold this winter, which we didn't have a hard winter. We had, you know, a couple weeks there where temperatures got down, and then a few days where they got down below zero, I think, and that's whenever we lost birds. So right now on our homestead, we're not really having any real fits with weather.
What about you guys?
Well, for me, I've never lost a bird to cold weather, ever. But my building is a little more weatherproof. As long as I can keep water open, the birds thrive. And I have wonderful winter egg production. And again, I should verify that when I say we've never lost a bird, that's egg layers. We don't start our broiler production until February. And then we've got biddies that are in the brooder at that time. So, you know, March, April, it's starting to warm up pretty good before the broilers actually make it outside. But for us, it's more of a predator issue in that we lose a lot of birds to either snakes or owls. The snakes will eat up biddies in a hurry, and the owls as well, so, particularly baby guineas that want to fly up into the trees.
So as we move on a little bit and look a little bit at some of the different types of poultry housing, we've got so many different options available to us today. I know you can do a quick Google search and you can find chicken coops, you can find chicken tractors, there's aviaries, and all these different designs have different suitabilities for different species. What are you guys' thought on some of these different designs? I know, Bo, you do the tractors. Is that something you're sold on, or are you looking at maybe a more permanent housing solution?
So I'm going to go the dream world here. It is what I would talk about, because I think there's benefits to all of them. I think a chicken is happiest and most productive whenever they're free range, by far. I think we get a higher quality egg, higher quality meat. We get birds that, you know, we were walking around the other night, just spending time with the animals, and I think we have some show quality egg layers just walking around our farm. And I think that's largely due to the amount of time that they get to spend free ranging. So best case scenario, like if money was no object and you just said, we're going to have the best possibility or the best possible chickens in production that we can, I would say some kind of mobile coop with several hundred foot of like the electric chicken netting, to where, you know, like the problem me and Joe are having, once they find the garden, you have to enclose them. So if you could limit that and keep them in a certain space and not tear up the garden, like I think that would be one of the best case scenarios. I like our chicken tractors, but it's something that you have to be dedicated to every day. You have to move those birds every day. And really, like I said, twice a day. So I love our chicken tractors. I paid a lot of money for them. I don't know that they are the best solution. And you're limited on the number of birds you can keep. So I think there's some middle ground. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I agree 100%. I don't think it matters what species of animal we're raising. The happier they are, the more productive they'll be. And that's dogs or chickens or rabbits or what have you. So it's really important that we think about their space. You know, according to our government, 18 square inches is about all we need to raise a layer hen. I find that absurd. I think the bigger space, the better they are. Three square foot minimum. If you're looking to say, oh, I need 10 eggs. And by the way, let's do our math to back into that. How many birds does a family need? How many eggs are you eating? How many eggs do you want to eat? To go in there and say, I need 100 birds without any understanding of how often do you eat chicken? How many broilers do you eat? I mean, really, if you're going to only eat chicken three times a month, it's a quarter pound per person. Let's do the math and figure out how many birds. You may not need nearly the number of birds that you think you need. But then if you decide on a particular breed of bird, you know, 3 to 4 square feet minimum, the bigger breed will need 4 square feet minimum space in a caged environment. But that's minimum production. To get maximum production and to have, like Bo, what you said, show quality birds, we need to maximize that, the quality of life for them, to get the maximum amount of nutrition into our eggs or nutrition into our meat. So free range is obviously where I would go as well. But it also depends on where we're at. You know, if we were raising chickens in Wyoming or Montana where they have a wolf population or bobcats, you know, we would need a far different setup than what we have here in Missouri. You know, I have a dog here, and I want to make sure we understand that livestock guardian dogs do really well with chickens. You know, something to think about. I've got a dog that runs off any bird that flies by. She takes off running and barking if it doesn't belong here. So hawks and eagles and buzzards that all circle my farm, my dog keeps them run off. And that's the kind of dog you need to think about, or that's the kind of system that we need to protect against. You know, eagles eat a lot of chickens in this neighborhood. We're fortunate to have a large population of bald eagles. But they'll take off with some chickens. So do we need something an overhead covering to keep our chickens safe? Well, if you're married to that particular chicken and you're worried about Henrietta Cluck as an individual, then absolutely we need to really, you know, maybe the netting isn't the way to go. Maybe you need something that's more substantial than that. But for my operation, I think the ideal situation would be a mobile coop with the netting that you spoke about. And I think that just works here. It may not work at all in Wyoming or Montana or any place where predators are more invasive than what we have. But for Southwest Missouri, I think you're right, Mo. That's probably the best solution that we can come up with.
I think something interesting you said at the beginning of that was the minimal space requirement. And I think everybody sitting at this table, I mean, we are never shooting for the minimal.
No.
With anything. I mean, I think when they say the minimal, you know, square footage or whatever for an animal is for that animal to survive.
Correct.
I don't think they factor in any kind of well-being or enjoyable life for that animal.
No dignity, no spirituality, no nothing, no fun.
Yeah.
You know, and if you think chickens don't have fun, you don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
Chickens are sometimes malicious and mean, and they like to tease one another.
Yeah.
You know, we really need to pay attention to those types of behaviors. And I don't think that an animal can produce well for us if they're not allowed to exhibit all of their behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important because a lot of listeners starting out are gonna look that up because we started talking about beware of your square footage. Don't pay so much attention to the minimal square footage for a chicken or even the minimal acres for, you know, cattle or sheep or whatever, because we always want to do better than that.
I think we talked a little bit about it last time, and it will still be an exciting experiment. I'm going to get me some spent hens, and we're just going to see the change that we can make in those hens in, you know, 30, 60, 90-day period.
Yeah, I think we have to do it scientifically where we weigh them even.
Yeah, and we can definitely get into that. We can throw them on the scale and take some pictures and, you know, Jesse, as far as you're concerned, you know, see what their feathers look like day one versus day 90. See what their weight is day one versus 90. See what their egg production is day one versus day 90.
Their personality.
Personality.
Like, we'll see a personality change in those.
Your
birds.
Posture changes.
Mm-hmm.
I try to think of it as like, can a human live in a 6x6 spot? Sure, we can, but we're not going to be happy.
Yeah, we call that jail.
Right, it's jail. So I try to say I don't want to do that to my animals either.
So as we get ready to wrap up this first segment here, we've got a little bit of understanding maybe of some of the poultry housing considerations we need to have. What are some of the big key considerations if we are designing and building our poultry housing, whether that's a coop tractor, whatever, what are some key things we need to consider when we're doing this?
I'll jump in there, and I don't think we discussed it much, but we need to talk about burrowing animals, and that could be a fox, the old adage of a fox in the hen house. Most likely that fox is getting a bad rap for your neighbor's dog. So certainly where you live and what kind of dog issues. I think most of the predator problems that are incurred by homesteaders would be the neighborhood dogs. So we need to put something down and about a 3-foot barrier of some sort of wire flat on the ground that the grass will grow up through to prevent the dogs from digging under. I think that's something that has to happen if you, again, are very focused on the longevity of that particular chicken. Again, for my house, if a dog gets in and takes a chicken, it's not the end of the world. I don't name them. I feel bad, but I don't feel, for me, it's worth the extra expense to put 3 foot of wire all the way around my chicken coop. But for others that live in town and maybe have a different, more of an emotional connection with their birds, certainly we can. My mother, for example, is a prime example of this. She does not want her birds hurt in any way, shape, or form. She lives in town, and the possibility of dogs eating her birds is very high. It's happened before, and likely will happen again. So we have to have a barrier, a buried barrier around her coop.
Jesse, what about you? What are some key considerations that you've got for our listeners?
We have, over our turkeys, we have an overhead fence because we have a lot of problems with owls. Like I said, we don't free range at our house, so that is a lot of problem. And having somewhere for those big enough for your animals to go inside out of the rain and to roost at night. I feel like you can have a 200-yard, place for them to play during the day, but if there's nowhere to sleep at night, they're miserable laying out there in the rain, too.
That's a good point, Jesse.
Bill, what are any comments here?
So, I mean, I've done quite a bit of my own building. We played around with the rabbit tractor idea, so I built some of that. That I know there's a bunch of controversy on what kind of wood to use around your animals. But I can tell you, we use treated lumber. It holds up the best to the ground. I'm not going to pay for cedar because at that point, we could buy 10 times the amount of meat from the store as we could raise because cedar is outrageous. So I haven't had any problems using just treated lumber to build, chicken tractors, rabbit tractors, greenhouses, sheep sheds. I don't worry about any of that. So, but I really like the portability, and I think that's something that everybody should keep in mind, especially if you've got a little bit of acreage, is portability in those things can be really, really valuable as you change directions on your homestead and maybe decide that where your chickens are at right now, you really want to be your garden area. Well, if I had, cemented posts in the ground for a chicken coop, it would make that a lot harder. So if it's possible, portability, I think, is a really, really good idea.
I think maybe scalability is a bit of a concern. Like me being the new guy starting out, I want to start out with a few chickens, but eventually I would like to grow that.
Chicken math. It's real.
Got to do some math there and figure out, okay, this is where I am today, but tomorrow is going to be a whole different ballgame. Yep. So I think for me, I'll probably start off. I think I'm just going to go the frugal route, and we talked a little bit last week about some of the coops that they had on Amazon, and I think I'm just going to get on there and I want to find something that looks relatively durable, as close to $100 as I can find. And I think that'll be a good place to start, but I'm doing that with the mindset of, hey, in the future I want to grow a little bit, so I don't necessarily want to build a coop. again, another consideration for me, I'm on a rent property, so building permanent infrastructure, probably not the greatest idea on a rent place. I can probably get permission. I don't know if I could or not, but is that a good use of my resources? So I think that's kind of where I'm going to start. But scalability, where I'm at today, may not be necessarily where I'm going to be tomorrow. So I think that's a good consideration for us to keep in mind.
I'll add to that in saying that 100 years ago, when my chicken barn was built, my home was probably a dirt road with maybe one car a day. And although we're the only people that live on my road today, it's the traffic is much higher than it was 100 years ago. So 20 yards from the road then was a good idea. I wish my coop were 100 yards off the road. Because we do lose chickens and guineas to roadkill. And we have neighbors that just drive by and run them over and never stop. Or send me a dirty text that said we had to touch our brakes because your chickens were in the road. So it's something we need to consider for sure. I think the idea of having a portable or movable coop is certainly something we should all consider.
Around here, we've got this beautiful red clay and rock. And if you find a good sized rock, it looks a lot like a chicken. You just put that out in the road and your neighbors will slow down immediately. I'm just joking. So as we move on here a little bit, let's talk about building that infrastructure. So what are, as we get into this next segment here, what are some practical tips and guidelines for building that infrastructure on the homestead? Bo, I know you alluded a little bit to using treated lumber. So when we are choosing materials, what are suitable materials for us to use in that construction?
So I think for most people, it's what you have or can afford is the primary. There are going to be people that will watch this or listen to this podcast and will ridicule the fact that I mentioned treated lumber in a chicken coop. But again, I think it's probably okay. And the treated lumber today is not like the treated lumber from 25, 30 years ago, whenever that was. It's different. The chemicals are not the same. It's
far safer.
Far safer. But, you know, I think too many times we get on a YouTube rabbit hole and we... or chicken hole. We're going to call it a YouTube chicken hole tonight. And see all these beautiful, you know, $1,000, you know, chicken tractors that, you know, they'll show you how to build and then, you know, sell you the plans for an extra $29.95. And it really doesn't take all that much. Chickens, and I'm talking chickens. I don't have turkeys or guineas or anything, so they'll have to speak to that. But if you're looking at chickens, which I think, you know, the majority of our listeners are going to be interested in, it just really doesn't take that much. And, you know, material-wise, use what you have or what you can afford. You know, if right now all you can afford is, you know, the standard stud lumber, which is untreated, you know, build your first coop out of that and see how it works. See if you like chickens. See if the production's there. That's where I would go with the materials.
Bo or Jesse, do you have any life lessons that you've learned about building your coops?
Luckily, my dad worked in construction, so I'm a little spoiled. So if I just show him a picture, he just makes it. So that's been nice. However, I have started with pins that were just too small. And I'm like, well, it's nice until I go to this farmer's market, and then I'm like bringing six random birds home that I don't know where I'm going to put. So... make sure it's big enough for chicken math or turkey math or quail math. I also, like, try to make it easy enough to clean. There was this one time I had just the chicken door to get in this coop. Stupidest thing I ever done. So then you're trying to crawl through a chicken coop to get in there to shovel it out, and it's just not okay. Make sure that there's a way to get in and out.
You know, for me, I think it's really important that we focus on what we use, and I agree with Bo in saying that we need to use what you have available. And having traveled globally, I can tell you that there's a lot of different materials. Palm fronds are used to weave walls for chicken coops. Bamboo in Asia is a wonderful material that's used to keep chickens But here in the Midwest, I think it's important that we build a building that's going to keep our birds freezing. And that's why I didn't, from freezing, and that's why I don't have an issue, is that my building is tight enough to prevent drafts and to keep birds from freezing to death. They'll sit close together. They'll mass up. Their body heat will keep them relatively warm. But conversely, we don't need to have it so airtight that we have ventilation related issues. We don't want drafts, but we don't need it completely sealed either. So, you know, we're not looking at building a sauna necessarily to keep them in ideal temperatures. We're just looking to keep the cold at bay. So, get started, use what you have. Don't be afraid to make mistakes and learn. You know, if you have a bird that dies because of cold weather related, that's unfortunate and it's sad, but it's also a great learning opportunity. So just like Jesse, when you have to crawl through a door and say, I wish I'd planned on the manure removal, the next design is a no-brainer for you.
Right.
So don't let your ignorance keep you from getting started. Don't let your materials or your financial position be a stopping point. Get started with it. Make the mistakes. And understand you'll have more invested in your coop than you will in your birds.
Sounds like there's just a whole range of options here. And you can go get a bunch of pallets and you can build a chicken coop out of that. Absolutely. Or you can spend $1,500 building a chicken mansion. I think it's maybe worth considering too, like if you're starting now and as we're getting into summer, you don't necessarily have to worry about the cold until September, October. So if I want to get into chickens, you know, my coop doesn't necessarily have to be perfect today. I can build me some sort of enclosure to house my chickens and I can make improvements on that. And, you know, like Jesse learned, you know, maybe I need a bigger door. We're going to have some learning curve there. We're going to learn a lot of things about not only functionality just in general, but about personal preference and how I want my coop to look. How I want my coop to look isn't necessarily how Bo wants his to look. And that's okay. I think that's perfectly okay, but we just need to kind of start somewhere and then have a mindset of, hey, I can improve this later on down the road. So we talked about chicken doors and ease of cleaning and maintenance. What features can we incorporate to promote our flock health and our general well-being? Are there any big things that we can do to promote that?
For me, it's a daily feeding. You know, we go to the farm stores and we see feeders, we go to the poultry supply houses, we see feeding operations. We're sort of tricked into keeping free choice feed in front of our birds all day long. And all that does really is invite rodents and gluttony. And I don't think the birds really thrive when they can eat whenever they want. I think they thrive on schedule. So, you know, where used to be, I'd go down and add 20 pounds to a feeder, a big vessel that would allow them to have what we call ad libitum feed or free choice feeding. That was something I thought was the way to go. I've since learned that it's the birds do much better. They're far more productive. They grow far better. They stay cleaner. I have less poop to clean up, less guarding of the food area. If I go out and throw out a handful of feed every day. So I've gone away from filling a container to a daily rationing of grain.
I do that same thing. I got away from free choice feed. And I think chickens are kind of messy eaters. So, you know, I could notice, you know, on a daily basis, the hanging feeder that I had up, there was a ring of spilled feed underneath that, yeah. You know, every day. Because they didn't have to bend down and pick that up. They could just get right back in, you know, to the free choice feed. And again, I think if you're talking about health, I think it's another big promotion on either the free range or the daily move tractor is those chickens are never, you know, in their own feces. And I think we've learned that, you know, that is maybe the biggest health concern, Jay.
Sure. Yeah, I would say I agree 100%.
So, being able to move them and force them off of that, you know, is a big bonus in that. So, and if you're not doing that, I mean, you know, there's several deals there you can think about, you know, like, you know, slatted floors, you know, maybe in your chicken coop to keep that there, or adding the wood chips and stuff, keep you know, to continue piling that on to keep them off of that. Yeah, the deep litter beds. So I think that's things to keep in mind. And again, you know, I talked about it on the last one, the last episode we did, but a frozen 2-liter bottle of water going into your chicken waters will change a bird's entire outlook in the summer.
To talk a little bit, we're not necessarily doing or not necessarily promoting free choice feeding. I think maybe that has a little bit of play, especially with your chicken tractors. You know, when the grain's there and it's easy and it's, you know, cheap for the chickens, at least in the chicken's head, hey, this is where the grain at, this is where I eat. When you restrict that feed a little bit and say, hey, I'm not just going to feed you everything you want, maybe I'm going to eat a little bit more of that forage on the ground. Maybe I'm going to eat some more of those bugs. And you encourage your birds to have a little bit more diverse palate, and they're going to eat a lot more things. It certainly probably a reduction in your feed bill. Well, not only in waste, yeah,
like at least doing the controlled feedings, you know what your feed bill is going to be, as opposed to, you know, free feed. You know, Joe might have dumped that 20-pound bag and came back out the next day and went, holy crap, it's empty. You know, I mean, the birds may have just been idiots that day and been flying food everywhere. So it's for sure a more controlled feed spend.
What are you doing, Jesse? Are you doing free feed, or are you doing more of a controlled feed?
We do controlled as well. We feed depending on what day, every morning or every night. Now we have enough birds that sometimes we do have to fill the feeder up every morning or every night.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean necessarily it's empty, but they see you and they know it's time to eat, so they come running.
You know, I used to deliver way back in the old days, I delivered feed to the zoos, and it's amazing to see the difference it makes in the animals' overall well-being when they have that type of schedule. So when they see you, they associate that with something pleasurable. And I really think that that impacts the quality of our meat, both in chickens and swine and beef as well. You know, I don't think it's fair for an animal to see you and only associate negativity. So when you go out there and say, hey, there comes Farmer Tyler, there comes Farmer Jesse, she's going to make my day better. That's really what we're kind of going for.
I don't think we pay enough attention to that. I think hormones have a huge influence on the way that our meat tastes and on the way that the nutrient quality of our meat that we're harvesting. And when you have a, you know, if you're going out there every day and you're yelling and cussing and screaming at your chickens, you can call me stupid if you want, but I think that puts a lot of stress on your birds, and it's going to lower the quality of your eggs. It's going to lower the quality of your meat. Having a good relationship where, you know, you're happy to see them and they're happy to see you, as silly as it sounds, I think that makes a difference.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's silly at all, Tyler. I think it makes a difference. You know, we say here on this farm always and often, it's how it's bred, it's how it's fed, which means the care for, and how it's dead. The quality of the eggs has everything to do with the conditions in which the bird lives. So make sure you don't miss out on any of that opportunity to make them better.
I think that's a good place for us to slide into our next setup, or our next segment, I'm sorry. We're just going to talk for a few minutes about our own poultry setups, and just, I kind of want everybody to give our listeners just kind of a day in the life of your poultry setup. What does your housing look like? What does your watering look like? What does your feed look like? And maybe how those are different, how those are the same, and how our listeners can do something similar or choose to do something different.
Well, I'm afraid that I've kind of jumped again because we were over this. But so I'll try to give like the virtual tour. So we have two, and I'm fairly certain they're 6x8 chicken tractors. They are on wheels. They have a white canvas top over them. And then out the back, they have rollout egg boxes. And for those that don't know, that means as soon as the chicken lays the egg, it rolls outside of the laying box. And that keeps the egg clean. It keeps the chickens from pooping on that all day. So we have two of those. We have a 2-gallon water bucket that is tubed down into an automatic water so that As the chickens drink the water that's in a little round tray at the bottom, it relieves pressure and lets the water flow around that cone again and fill it back up. And then we have, it's probably close to a 2 gallon feeder, but again, we don't fill it up. We just feed a ration every day. And then as far as feed, I'm using the local farm store here right now, and I'm mixing really about equal parts layer pellets, crumble, and then bird seed, and trying to give them a pretty good mix like that. And that's pretty well my entire chicken setup. As far as the quail go, which is the only other poultry that I have right now, we talked about, I have a Winona Ranch three-tier quail cage that holds my quail. I feed a game bird mix to those quail, and they also have kind of a it's like a cup system, so I've got a 5 gallon bucket that sets up on top of it with a hose that runs to 2 cups per level of those of that cage system. And as the birds, you know, drink enough water out of it, the spring on the cup raises and then it releases water and it fills the cup, and the cup goes back down and it stops. So it makes a lot of that a lot easier, because we don't have to water birds every single day with the number of birds that we have right now. And again, they're not wasting any. I think that's huge, because, you know, birds can waste a lot of feed and water just by splashing around and making a mess. And systems like those really, really help. And with the quail, the feed and the water are both actually on the outsides of the cage, so they have to stick their heads through the cage to eat and to water themselves. So that helps with that too. And that's our setup.
I know maybe a little bit difficult to visualize. We've been trying to keep up with our social media, so we'll try and get some pictures of everybody's setups. And of course, it'll be a little bit before I get mine because I haven't ordered yet, but we'll definitely get some pictures of that up to you. Joe, what have you got going on? Particularly something we haven't talked a lot about this podcast, nest boxes. So what are you doing with your eggs? What have you got for nest boxes, or what's your system there?
So my coop is, again, it's probably 20 square foot. 100-year-old building. It's divided in, there's one side that's a third, there's a wall that divides that square building, and probably a third of it is designed to what we call the brooder section. The other side is the hen house. The hen house has got a roll-out nest box in it that's, now I can't think of it. It's a brand name. We need to look it up. Anyway, it's a production roll-out box that I bought recently. We live, like Tyler said earlier, we live in poultry country. So I had a rollout box before it rolled out to the back. I've changed it, and now I have a rollout to the front. I'm not sure if I like it any better, but it certainly took up less room. Got a ladder in there for roosting. I practice the deep litter system. We use shavings, hen gear. Thank you, Bo. I bought a hen gear brand rollout nest box. It's about 3 birds wide, and I think it's designed for up to 18 birds. But 3 birds at a time will sit in there and lay eggs side by side. It's got a flip-down perch that allows them to we can flip it up if we need to block them out of the box at nighttime, for example. We don't want birds to sit in there and defecate. But we need to remember that 80% of chicken poop comes out of the bird at night while they're on the roost.
80%
of a chicken's waste comes out at night. So where they roost,
shit the bad Ethel.
So we want to make sure that wherever they roost at, that we have a way to clean under the roost more frequently than other parts. So the old adage about chicken poop on the pump handle and this and that, really it's chicken poop underneath the roost. So we use sawdust, and we use our shredded paper from the household, our junk mail and newspaper gets all shredded, and I put that underneath my roosts. I stir it around every single day. So my work day includes going down, collecting eggs, throwing out some feed, adding some to the feeder, checking the water. Every single day I make sure that the water is not only filled but clean. I don't think that any animal does well. And, you know, we hear a lot, you know, oh, chickens used to drink in the swamp. Yeah, that's true, but they're not production animals. They're wild animals. So for production animals, we know that water quality is paramount to production. So no sense spending a bunch of feed if we're going to make them drink filthy water. So for me, it's absorbing the poop, you know, with deep litter system and clean water, I think are absolutely as important as the feed. Bo uses a local feed. I have some feed that comes from Oklahoma, Big V feed, that I'm just sold on. I'm new with it. The birds are excited to eat it and seem to be more voracious than they've ever been before. So, you know, a month ago, I would have laughed if you told me that birds can show a preference, but guys, I've seen it. This last couple of weeks has been amazing, and I don't plan on switching anytime soon.
Jesse, what about you? Do you have a nest box set up? What have you got? What are you?
So for my quail, I have a 4-foot by 12-foot. I call it the grow out pen. There's no separation other than a little door they can go to and get out of the wind and rain and whatever. That there's no tray or anything. That just goes right on the ground, probably about 4.5 foot high. I've got two single quail cages that I do a lot of my breeding pairs in. And then I've got two of the 3-tier as well. And all of mine are set up like bows with the 5-gallon bucket and the cups. For feed, I mentioned last week about the shoebox, because all they can stick through that shoebox is their head after I drill the holes in it. So they can't be scratching it and wasting it, pulling it out in the poop trays. My chickens, so I have 15 roosters right now. But it's just for feathers for fly tying. So I have taken over my mom's chicken tractor and part of my brother's chicken setup. So my mom's got a chicken tractor as well. It's got the ramp that they can walk up. But we have the boxes. There's a place on the back you can lift up and get the eggs out of there if you needed to. They have the cups as well. My brother has probably 12-foot by 8-foot place for them to chickens to get out with a run. We use the deep litter method in there as well. But we do the quail, I use the rollout, but the chickens, we just have nesting boxes. And then turkeys, deep litter method on that as well with waterers we fill up every day. And I do have some shade cloth over the top of theirs. They would be in the bald open sun. We had some problems with them just overheating. So I put some garden shade cloth over the top of it, and that has helped dramatically. And they have a place to get out of the, like a little house to get out of the wind and rain as well.
So as we think about kind of our own poultry setups, I'm kind of the new guy and I haven't really got my own setup yet. So I think for me, I'm just going to get on Amazon and I'm going to see how close I can get to $100. I'm going to find me a little chicken coop or a chicken tractor. I've seen quite a bit of options out there. I think that's where I'm going to start. But one of the things that really interests me, and this will kind of segue in us into our next segment, I really want to have a focus on producing my own protein and feeding my chickens off of the homestead. So as we move into this next segment, we had a little bit of dialogue with one of our listeners and maybe a little bit of questions. And one of the things that he brought up was black soldier fly farming for the production of protein and the supplement of chicken feed. And I think this is really kind of an interesting topic that we can get into a little bit today. So Joe, do you want to kick us off and tell us a little bit about black soldier fly farming and maybe even more generally insect production, not only as an innovative way to produce protein for our livestock, but also as a sustainable method to manage our waste?
Yeah, Tyler, I think that's a great subject, and I'm really thankful for our listener that brought that up. I think that was a local guy, so kudos and welcome. But I do want to take it out just a little bit from black soldier fly to insect or novel proteins in general. So there, first of all, we need to understand that our planet in general still operates in what we call calorie deficit. So here in the United States, we have very few people that are actually going hungry. Globally, that's not so true. Our planet is still struggling to get enough calories into our population as a whole. Not true in Western Europe, not true in the United States or North America in general, but the rest of the world struggles. So we really need to understand that, you know, to the old adage of eating high off the hog, you know, most of the planet has no such thing as byproduct or waste product. Every single part of the animal is consumed by the human population. For example, you travel to Haiti. We know that Haitians love to eat as a snack food the chicken entrails. We're lucky to get our dogs to eat that here in the U.S. So when we consider that there's not enough calories to go around, we need to look at insects as a viable option. Mealworms, crickets, and of course the black soldier flies are all a very important part of the equation. And will continue to get more important as our population, our global population grows. So black soldier flies are something we can do on the farm that eat up large volumes of waste product, particularly meats and viscera that we're not typically composting. Kitchen wastes of all kinds, the black soldier flies thrive on that, but they do particularly well with the higher protein and the fatty things that don't compost. Mealworms do better on vegetable proteins. Crickets, of course, are very specific, and we have to be very cautious. They're subject to infections, so we want to feed them a prepared ration, much like a chicken egg-laying pellet or crumble. But all of them have the benefit of producing far more calories than they consume. And we're fortunate to have that. On the homestead, we talked about quail and tilapia and things that are producing calories on a large scale with very little input. There's nothing that will outperform an insect. So beetles, different beetles should be considered. We have the Japanese beetle as the scourge of every gardener, but chickens and guineas do very, very well on it. So if we can figure out a way to put Japanese beetles in a hen house, you would certainly cut your diet. Today, soldier fly larvae are freeze-dried and shipped. Mealworms in general, are freeze-dried and shipped, and they are not viable if you were to buy some at your local feed store. You cannot afford to do that. So they're marketed to the backyard chicken lover as a chicken treat. They can be a significant part of their entire diet, but it's just not at all cost effective because of the logistics and it takes to get a mealworm from a mealworm producer to a freeze dryer, to a packager, to a retail outlet, and finally to your home. If you circumvent all of that by producing the mealworms on your farm or the black soldier fly larvae on your farm, obviously then you will save a ton of money. And it's something that's very important. When we go to feeding chickens a scratch grain diet only, their egg production drops. Bo and I talked about that when we catch our chickens and take them out of free range situations and put them in the coop. The reason their productivity falls is not only because of their happiness, if you will, but because their protein levels were not being met from the insects that they would find naturally. So supplementing their diet with insects is critical if we want to keep their production up. So an easy way, a cheap way to do that is to build some soldier fly containers and start down that. And it's as easy to do as vermiculture, which is the system that makes earthworms. And even vermiculture works well. That's another one that should be considered as a protein source for chickens. So certainly something we want to take a look at and that every homesteader can do economically and simply. And it's a great opportunity to learn.
Well, I know before we started the podcast, we all watched a little bit of a video just kind of bring us all up to speed on these black soldier fly farms. What are your thoughts on it? It looks like a pretty simple process to me. What are some things that maybe stuck out to you about that video? And is this something that you're excited about or something that you have more questions about? And if you do have more questions, what are those questions?
And we will link this video to the webpage.
So yeah, I'm very, very interested. Anytime I hear about a food source that could improve my chicken's life or improve the amount of dollar bills that I get to keep in my wallet, I'm excited about it. This was something that I was not familiar with at all. Thanks, Logan, for bringing it up. I'll just use your first name. I can at least use first names on here. He'll know who we're talking about. because this is one of those deals. I think this is the reason on our side that we're doing this podcast, because I don't know that we would, amongst the four of us, said, hey, let's talk about, you know, black fly larva. I don't know that that would have been a topic, but you start going into it, and the video we watched, the setup, you know, was really pretty easy. Joe said he thinks we can do it even simpler than that. So if it can be done even simpler than the video we watched, I'm not sure why all four of us sitting at this table don't give it a shot and see how it goes. And then the byproduct of having the, what do you call that, Joe, fertilizer tea?
Yeah, it's absolutely that. It's the liquid waste that comes off the food, but it's mixed with the frass. The insect waste is called frass.
So, you know, that video had kind of a turndown pipe that you could turn and drain off that liquid fertilizer, if you will, to use on your garden. So now all of a sudden we've talked about a super low cost startup on something that is going to feed my chickens and, you know, become a liquid fertilizer for my garden. You know, Joe just got through, I don't know if it was on the podcast or before, we were talking about the issues that I might see with the gutter garden that I was building. And he was talking about, you know, you're going to have to add some supplements to it. So maybe that's one of my supplements that I add to those.
Could be a little.
Yeah, to offset the extremely shallow soil that those are going to have to grow in. So, yeah, I'm all in. I want to give it a try.
So for me, kind of as the beginner here, going back all the way to our first podcast, we talked about compost being super important to the homestead. So for me, you know, I have been kicking around the idea of going and buying a 55-gallon drum and making a compost bin. I've had discussions with Joe a little bit about, you know, how much compost can I really produce? I'm a single guy. I don't have a whole lot of... I have more waste than I should, but I don't produce enough waste to have a full-sized compost bin. But this Black Soldier Fly Farming, you know, this ticks a lot of boxes in one. I've got a good compost source. I'm getting that liquid frass that's coming off of that, but also the organic material, I can scoop that out, you know, on a regular basis. I've got a good solid compost there. As I get chickens, I'm going to have protein. And I was reading some white papers earlier just on Black Soldier flies, and we think that maybe they can be even more prolific than what I've read. The number I read was about 50% protein, and that varies depending on what you're feeding these larvae. So that could be as much as, you know, 60% protein, you know, maybe down in the low 40s, depending on what you're feeding these flies. But that's a huge source of protein that I can feed to my chickens. I'm getting compost off of it. I'm getting liquid compost off of it. And one of the cool things about these Black Soldier flies, you know, for somebody that's doing gardening or whatever, they only eat in their larval stage. So once they become a mature adult fly and they fly out of that compost bin, they're not eating your tomatoes. They're not eating your cucumbers. They're not eating on your garden. So
Or your children.
Yeah. They're not biting at you. Yeah. They're kind of scary looking. If you just look at the fly, it kind of looks almost waspish.
Yeah.
But they don't have mouth parts. They don't have stingers. They're not biting at you. They're not stinging you.
They don't swarm your picnic.
Not eating your garden, not swarming your picnic. So this is kind of a kind of an exciting thing for me to find. And I'm glad that Logan brought it up to us. Jesse, have you heard about this? Or are you familiar with this at all?
I've heard about some of it, but I didn't know about using the waste on your garden. What we have is just, we have a 5-gallon bucket hanging in the chicken pen, and we just let regular old house flies lay their eggs in it, and it's got a bunch of holes in it. So when the larvae are squirming around, they fall out of those holes, and the chickens will literally just sit there and wait to eat those larvae or maggots coming out of there. So I think doing it on a bigger scale would be pretty cool. And I didn't know that you could use it on your garden, so that's interesting.
So I do have one question about it. So to initially get the black flies there, is that something we have to purchase? Do they just naturally come into that?
I think per me and Joe's conversations, I think they're fairly native to our area. I don't know if that's going to apply to all of our listeners. And, you know, again, this may be something that's, you know, super beneficial to somebody that lives in Southwest Missouri, may not be applicable to everybody. But for us, I think you just got to put the compost in there, set up space for the flies to lay their larvae. So let me just kind of rewind here for a little bit. So for this farm, if you will, to produce these flies, you're going to take a tote. In super simple terms, you're going to put a piece of cardboard and you're going to hang that over your compost or your substrate, because these flies actually lay their larvae or lay their eggs above that compost. So when those eggs hatch, they're going to hatch and that larva is going to fall down into that substrate. From there, that the larva are going to eat that compost. They're going to break down that compost. They're going to produce that liquid fertilizer. And in their larval stage, they're going to live in that compost. My understanding, and Joe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is once those larvae begin to mature, you're going to have a piece of PVC or some sort of a ramp, some way for that larva to get out of that substrate. They're going to climb up out of there. And the video that I'm referencing used a milk container and just some PVC pipe to catch the adult black flies. And or black soldier flies, you're gonna catch those adult flies and you're gonna feed them to your chickens.
Adult larvae.
Adult.
Mature larvae.
Mature larvae. So they're not quite
fly off.
So the flies are gonna leave. So the larvae you're gonna catch kind of at the peak of their larvae stage before they turn into an adult, and you're gonna feed the larva to your chickens. I hope, did I do a decent job explaining that?
I think on our Facebook page we'll be able to link a video. You know, for people listening, they need to make sure to like our Facebook page, because I think we'll put, you know, maybe a link to that on there. It sounds like at least one or two of us will surely build one of these, so maybe we can get our own video up on what we build.
I see a 12-pack and some plastic totes.
Yeah. So probably what we'll do is we'll probably go ahead and link that. The original video that I watched, we'll link that. And then I've already got a tote. I think we can be into a black soldier fly farm for less than $30. So I've got a tote. We're going to go buy some BBC. We'll probably try and do another video like you did, Bo. And we'll build our own variation of that. And then people can kind of see what the fly farm looks like. I know it's difficult when we're doing an audio podcast and trying to describe these things. But to me, super interesting. And again, it's at, you know, 50 to 60% protein, and they're super high in fat. These black soldier flies, they're producing biodiesel out of these things. I mean,
fat only. The protein is still fat.
Yeah. So you're still getting that protein and you're getting biodiesel out of these things. I mean, they're just super, super productive. And I never would have thought that we'd be talking about farming bugs on here, but there's so much that we can glean through these things.
Guys, it has to happen. It's already taken place in Western Europe. Folks, you know, they're incorporating that into the human food stream, certainly in the animal food stream, pets, the pet food space. You know, the insect protein is becoming ever more viable. And we need to remember that at 50 to 60% protein, potted egg only averages 54% protein. So, you know, when we think about how expensive powdered egg is versus how inexpensive insect protein can be, and remember that we're in a calorie-deficient environment, I think it's just absolutely, again, God's gift to the farmer.
Well, I think we can get as deep into the woods on this as we want, but not only are we producing protein, but one of the things that we're going to talk about in some of our future podcasts is food miles. And yes, we're going to focus a lot on food miles for human consumption. But when we can close that nutrient cycle, not only for us, but for our animals, how much better nutrient are we going to produce for our chickens, knowing that we've closed that cycle and we've reduced, instead of buying grain from Nebraska and hauling to our chickens, we're producing that nutrient on our farm. And we can really close that cycle.
I think that's important. As anybody that is in this lifestyle, I think it's important for us all to realize that when we have asparagus out of season, for our own vanity, we want to eat asparagus in September. That has to come at somebody else's expense, and that has huge ramifications, huge implications all over the globe. So we need to see what we can do about, eating locally, not only for ourselves, but for our animals.
I know this is kind of a new thing, at least for me and for Bo. I know Joe's got a little bit of experience and a little bit of knowledge when it comes to these. For you guys, if you guys have experience with black soldier fly farming, or if you've got experience with mealworms or whatever you're doing to produce that protein on your farm, reach out to us, give us some comments, let us know what you're doing, what works, what doesn't work, and we would love to explore that with you guys. All right, so that kind of, I think, wraps up our last segment today. Let's just take a couple of minutes and think about some of the key points that we've talked about today. Bo, what were some big things in our discussion today that stuck out to you?
So, I think we've all agreed that some amount of free ranging on your chickens is extremely healthy for your flock. It's just a matter of making them your partners in your homestead instead of becoming your enemies whenever they're digging around in the gardens.
Joe, what about you? Any big key points that you've walked away with today?
Yeah, I think I'd just like to conclude with the statement that if you don't see the chickens that you're, if they're not your chickens, or if you're buying chickens, or if you don't have a relationship with those chickens. So, for example, if you're buying eggs from the farmer's market and they say they're free range or cage free, if you're not seeing them with your own eyes and feel like they're being accepted, there's a lot of wiggle room in those statements. To go in your local grocery and buy an egg that says cage free or free range or organic doesn't necessarily mean those chickens are in a better space. So make sure that you have a relationship with those farmers or with those chickens. If you don't own them, make sure that you go see them on a regular basis and that you're happy with how they look and act. A chicken needs to scratch and move, and cluck, and fluff its feathers, and fight with other chickens or do what chickens do. And you can't see that from a logo on a box. You need to experience it firsthand.
Jesse, what about you? Any big things that stuck out to you today?
You don't have to be a millionaire to build a chicken coop. Just start with what you have. And it looks like we're going to be farming worms now.
Well said, Jesse.
Well, I appreciate you guys listening today. We're definitely enjoying this series on poultry. We'll probably look at doing some more series type episodes or programs in the future. Please follow up with us. Please subscribe. Please follow not only our podcasts, but follow our Facebook page and keep up with the next episode where we're going to talk just more about animal care and maintenance. We're going to really dive into the weeds on how are we taking care of our chickens? What are we feeding our chickens? And we're going to kind of get down into the dirt on that. Again, go to our Facebook page. Give us your comments. If you think we're idiots, tell us we're idiots. If you think we had a really good idea, tell us we had a really good idea. We want all of your feedback so we can have more material to talk about. And so we can not only learn from you guys, but we can also know what you guys want to learn.
This is your podcast in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is for you guys, and without you guys, it won't amount to much. So thank you guys for joining us. And there you have it, folks. Another enlightening episode of Farm Foundations comes to a close, marking the middle of our poultry series.
I know we've covered a lot of ground today, exploring the fascinating world of poultry and the many benefits they bring to the homestead.
Whether you're considering raising chickens for fresh eggs, ducks for pest control, turkeys for holiday feasts, there's a wealth of possibilities waiting for you in the world of poultry keeping.
As you jump in, we want you to really think about what infrastructure you have. We want you to assess your resources and just plan carefully to ensure that you have a successful and rewarding experience with your feathered friends.
You guys stay tuned for the next installment of our poultry series, where we'll dive deeper into the topic of care and maintenance for various bird species on the homestead.
Until then, happy homesteading, and may your coop be filled with clucks, quacks, and gobbles of joy.
Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time on Farm Foundations.